It is 3 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
A boat tragedy in Southeast Democratic Republic of Congo costs dozens of lives. Another doctor in Sierra Leone falls ill with Ebola. I'm Victor Beatty reporting from Washington. Tragedy in Southeastern Democratic Republic of Congo, where authorities say at least 129 people are dead after a boat capsized late last week. On a remote lake in this country's southeast, there are more than 230 survivors. The accident occurred late Thursday in the north of Katanga province near the town of Kalimi. The MV Mutambala was carrying passengers between Katanga and South Kivu province. Officials said strong winds and overloading may have been factors in the tragedy. In Sierra Leone, a 12th doctor reportedly has contracted the deadly Ebola virus. Dr. Victor Willoughby was confirmed as the latest physician to fall ill. 10 of the doctors have died. Last week, a group of doctors launched a strike demanding better medical treatment for health workers. In Liberia, officials have postponed senatorial elections scheduled for Tuesday until Saturday after the country's Supreme Court ruled the vote should go ahead despite the Ebola outbreak. A group of former government officials and political party representatives warned electioneering risked further spread of the deadly virus. On Friday, President Obama lauded U.S. public health and military efforts to contain Ebola in Liberia.
We have been able to take the lead in Liberia and to start bending the curve so that we're on a pathway to defeating the disease in Liberia. But we've still got a lot of work to do. And in two neighboring countries, Guinea and Sierra Leone, we've still got significant problems.
The Ebola death toll has climbed nearly 6,600 as of December 10, with more than 18,000 recorded cases. This is VOA News. Rights groups have warned the conflict in South Sudan is worsening as it enters a second year with ongoing violence, displacement, and mass hunger. Fighting broke out last December between forces loyal to President Salva Kiir and those who support his former Vice President Riek Machar. Lisa Schlein reports the UN Children's Fund has called the scale of the crisis staggering.
The UN reports the fighting between the government and rebels that erupted 1 year ago has displaced 1.5 million South Sudanese within the country. Nearly half of them are children. UNICEF Crisis Communications Chief Sarah Crowe says these children are increasingly vulnerable to sexual abuse and exploitation.
What we're seeing now is a future for a generation of children in South Sudan is really being stolen by this conflict. It's driven hundreds of thousands of children from their homes, schools and communities, subjecting them to violence, malnutrition and disease.
To respond to this crisis, UNICEF has scaled up its nutrition programs, providing therapeutic care to more than 80,000 severely acutely malnourished children. UNICEF is now pre-positioning life-saving supplies at key locations in Jonglei, Unity, and Upper Nile, the three contested states where needs are most acute. While all this aid is crucial for survival, UNICEF says what the people of South Sudan most need is peace. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Police in Sydney, Australia have sealed off an area of the central business district where gunmen are holding what appears to be more than three dozen people hostage inside a cafe. Police say nearby offices have been evacuated. Australia's Prime Minister Tony Abbott told a news conference no one yet knows the motivation of whoever's behind the incident.
New South Wales police are responding. They are being strongly supported by Commonwealth agencies. We don't yet know the motivation of the perpetrator. We don't know whether this is politically motivated, although obviously there are some indications that it could be.
The cafe where the incident is unfolding is located in the heart of Sydney's financial and shopping district. The president of Mauritius, Kailash Puryag, Sunday named veteran politician Sir Anirudh Jugnauth as prime minister. The 84-year-old won a landslide victory Wednesday. His centre-right alliance, EPEP, swept more than two-thirds of Parliament's 62 seats. Nigeria's two main oil workers' unions say they'll launch a strike today aimed at forcing passage of a law to improve efficiency, stem corruption, and tackle what are viewed as unfair labor practices. The unions say the job action is also a protest against refinery maintenance or lack thereof and the government's failure to reduce petrol prices at the pump to reflect the global drop in the price of oil. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa. From the Voice of America, I'm James Barton in Washington. Today is Monday, December 15th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. South Sudan's civil war marks 1 year today, Monday.
The one-year anniversary of fighting in South Sudan is a true tragedy, both for the people of South Sudan and for the hope which South Sudan represented for the continent.
Akshaya Kumar is the policy analyst on Sudan and South Sudan for the Enough Project. A Sudan official says President Bashir feels vindicated now that ICC prosecutor wants to stop her investigations in Darfur region. And Liberia's on and off against special senatorial election is scheduled to be held again this Saturday.
We call the political parties and other stakeholders to a meeting on Sunday. We all agree that the election should be adjusted finally to the 20th of December.
Jerome Kokoya is chairman of the National Elections Commission of Liberia. A court order is filed on the appointment of two vice presidents in Zimbabwe. A Ugandan entrepreneur advances girls' education, and Britain's Prince William accuses wildlife poachers of looting the planet. Those stories plus Mark Omar's sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Today, December 15, marks the one-year anniversary of the civil war in South Sudan. The conflict broke out last year after President Salva Kiir accused Vice President Riek Machar and five others of plotting to overthrow his government. It is estimated that 1.5 million South Sudanese have been driven from their homes, and both sides have been accused of committing atrocities. Akshaya Kumar is a policy analyst on Sudan and South Sudan for the Enough Project, an organization that aims to end genocide and crimes against humanity. She says her organization believes the only way to stop the violence and impunity is if there are severe consequences for those who undermine the peace process and orchestrate human rights abuses.
The one-year anniversary of fighting in South Sudan is a true tragedy, both for the people of South Sudan and for the hope which South Sudan represented for the continent as the first state to come to independence on the basis of a self-determination referendum. And our message to the people of South Sudan is that we as advocates in the United States of America stand with you, and we hope the U.S. government will stand with you as well to push for targeted sanctions on those leaders who are obstructing peace and responsible for grave human rights abuses.
Your organization says that the only way to stop the conflict is for there should be a severe consequence. What consequence can those people get?
The IGAD mediators have already on a number of occasions themselves said that those who deviate from the cessation of hostilities agreement or obstruct further peace should face targeted sanctions, specifically asset freezes and travel bans, to make those leaders who perhaps have family outside of the country and have their wealth stored elsewhere feel some of the pain which they are putting their own people through in South Sudan, where over 1 million remain displaced to this day.
You have been quoted as saying that the anniversary presents an opportunity for consumers in India and China to consider their stake in the war. What stake do people in India and China have?
From our perspective, the entire world is in a way connected to this conflict in South Sudan because of the oil exports that continue to flow through the pipeline from South Sudan through Sudan and out. And primarily that oil is bought by ONGC Videsh, the national oil company of India, and PetroChina, and therefore consumers in both of those countries are in some way connected to the conflict. And this anniversary presents an opportunity for them to consider their connection.
You mentioned the IGAD negotiations. The sticky point for that would be what? The disagreement over the roles that individuals should play in a transitional government.
What we know is that both sides have agreed to cease hostilities, and they've made this commitment and agreement a number of times over the past year, but they've failed to adhere to that promise and pledge. At the same time, as you say, they continue to disagree over which power certain leaders or members of the leadership structure will have. And it's our position that even as those discussions continue, both sides should adhere to and affirm their existing commitment to putting down their guns and stepping away from the front lines instead of doing what we see they're doing, which is resupplying, preparing for war, and advancing the battle.
Akshaya Kumar is policy analyst on Sudan and South Sudan for the Enough Project. She was speaking with me from New York City. Sudan's Minister of Information says President Omar al-Bashir feels vindicated now that the International Criminal Court prosecutor has said she wants to stop her investigations in Sudan's Darfur region, at least for now. Fatou Bensouda reportedly told the Security Council last week she wants to stop her investigation because no one has been brought to justice in a decade and the council has done very little or nothing to help. The ICC indicted President Bashir for orchestrating genocide, war crimes, and crimes against humanity in Darfur, but no African country has been willing to arrest him. Information Minister Ahmed Bilal says his country knew all along that the charges were politically motivated.
From the very beginning, we are saying the whole story is just as a political action. It is not a thing after justice. Our president had actually done a lot to bring peace in the country. The very eminent thing for that is he stopped the longest war in Africa, which cost us the cessation of the South and loss of third of our country, just because we want peace with the South. When he did that, some people who doesn't want calm in the area and peace in Sudan, they tried to bring the problem of Darfur.
Your president, President Omar al-Bashir, was indicted because of allegations of orchestrating atrocities in Darfur. Do you believe, or does your government believe, that now the ICC must drop these charges against your president?
I think this is a logical thing. From the very beginning, this was incorrect. And all this actually only for is a political indictment. It's not justified. We have seen now what they have done with Uhuru, the president of Kenya. It is just a fake thing without anything about the allegation against him. From our side, they don't want to make this. And now they reach this close end, and I think for their dignity and for them to make peace in Sudan, I think they have to revise.
Your government has been criticized by many, not just the opposition in Sudan, but by the United Nations Human Rights Commission over the recent arrest of the opposition people. I think they have come back from Cairo after signing an agreement. Your government has arrested at least three or so opposition members.
Yes, actually, these people, they refuse to join the national dialogue. You know, everybody here in Sudan is calling for peace and calling for the national dialogue. They went to Addis Ababa to convince the rebels not to come. And they have joined them to topple the regime, not through dialogue, but through resistance and war. What they want from us, to let them go freely and to come freely and to plot and these things, I think this is just a security measure. These people are going to be released. In fact, in other countries, we have seen the opposition leaders and even, you know, students in thousands, they go to jail without any comment from the so-called international community or others for calling for democracy and human rights, not even aware.
Even if you arrest three, people say in a country like yours, if you want a national dialogue, people should have a right to say what organization they want to join.
In fact, I think they should be released, and I'm calling for this. I myself calling for to be released.
Ahmed Bilal, Sudan's information minister. He was speaking with me from the capital, Khartoum. Today is Monday, December 15th, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. Daybreak Africa time is 14 and a half minutes past the hour. In Zimbabwe, the National Constitutional Assembly has filed a court order challenging the appointments of the country's two new vice presidents. Assembly spokesman Madok Chivasa says the group also challenges the constitutionality of assigning Vice President Emmerson Mnangagwa as justice minister.
We have submitted our finding affidavits signed by the NC chairperson, Professor Lavu Majuku, and we really just pointing out that the action by President Mugabe is unconstitutional to appoint two vice presidents. And we're also now saying he also, during today's ceremony where he was appointing cabinet ministers, he also said that the first vice president, Ms. Emmerson Mnangagwa, is also going to double also his legal affairs minister. And we are saying that that is also clearly unconstitutional. There is not such a provision where one person would be in a position to act as the national vice president of the country and also as just an ordinary cabinet minister. So we pointed out that in the same affidavit.
So do you think that you have got any chance of winning this case as far as you're concerned?
Yeah, of course, we have got sound legal arguments in it, and it's quite clear that the president acted unconstitutional when he today declared the two vice presidents. So it's our belief that the court is going to vindicate us, as then say it's the duty of the court to give examination on it.
Madok Chivasa is the spokesman for the Zimbabwe National Constitutional Assembly. He was speaking with Gibbs Dube of VOA Zimbabwe Service. Liberia's on and off again special senatorial election has again been rescheduled to December 20th after the country's Supreme Court rejected a petition brought against the National Elections Commission by a number of citizens to stop it. It was set to take place tomorrow, Tuesday. A member of the group told VOA earlier this month that the Election Commission was wrong to hold the election when Liberia has not yet been declared Ebola-free. But in giving the ruling, Supreme Court Judge Chief Justice Francis Kopoi said the petition was political and the court does not discuss political issues. National Elections Commission Chairman Jerome Kokoya says the commission is under legal obligation to hold the election before the end of this year.
The Supreme Court has recommended that the commission may consider compensation of lost time, that means campaigning and all the other activities. When we got that, we called the political parties and other stakeholders to a meeting on Sunday. We all agreed that the election should be adjusted finally to the 20th of December. The reason for that is the controlling law on the conduct of this election is Joint Resolution number 002, which I referred to earlier. And that resolution was adopted by the national legislature and approved by the president of Liberia. And that resolution mandated the commission to do the election not later than December 20th. So we cannot go beyond December 20th without violating that resolution. So therefore, those at today's meeting all agree, or women agree, that we push a date to the 20th. And that's what the commission has adopted, and that's what has been announced, and that's what we would implement.
Do you think, Mr. Chairman, that is enough time for the candidates to campaign? Because I think they have already lost a week when the court put a hold, a stay on the election.
You understand, Jim, that these are not normal times. First, this election should have been held on the 14th of October. And that was legally pushed back to the 16th of December. And while the candidates were getting ready, I think they had campaigned just for a week or so when these prohibitions, petitions were filed. So one could argue that the time not enough. But under the circumstances, I believe the time is enough. They all agree. They all saw that. So they got the additional 3 or 4 days that will be added. They can make the case that they could not make the 2 weeks that were taken away from them. This is particularly true because this is not normal time. These elections have to go on before January, I think the second or third Monday in January, and that's the goal.
In its ruling, the Supreme Court ordered your commission to put in place measures to reduce the further spread of Ebola. Did you comply with that, and what are the measures that you put in place?
Assuming the court ordered that, we will do that. As a matter of fact, prior to the ruling of the court, in consultation with WHO, the CDC, and that is the Center for Disease Control, and our own Ministry of Health and Social Welfare, we are working together to put in place a guideline that would minimize or prevent the spread of Ebola during the campaign and polling time.
Jerome Kokoya is chairman of the National Elections Commission of Liberia. You're speaking with me from the capital, Monrovia. Uganda entrepreneur Beatrice Ayuru says her dream of providing a quality education for girls who are often denied this basic right has become a reality for thousands. But she says advancing the cause of universal education is far from over. In an exclusive interview with VOA, Ayuru recounts the difficulties that she has encountered in establishing the Lira Integrated School for underserved students in a remote area of northern Uganda.
At age 43, Beatrice Ayuro has achieved more than most people in an entire lifetime. She has racked up an enviable list of awards and accolades from within Uganda and abroad. In 2010, Ayuro won first prize in the Women in Business Award given by the UN Conference on Trade and Development to women who excel in developing innovative business ideas that serve their communities. VOA caught up with this Ugandan entrepreneur before she addressed an overflow audience as one of a select group of speakers at a prestigious TEDx event. Her speech, entitled From Cassavas to Classrooms, aptly describes the long road she has had to travel to achieve her dream, that of building a school where girls could get the quality education normally denied them. Ayuro grew up in Lira, a largely impoverished rural region in northern Uganda. She is one of 16 children born into a well-off polygamous family. She was lucky to have had a father who valued education and supported her in her quest. But she says everything else, the poverty and cultural barriers that demean women in her society, worked against her ambition.
I would say the environment shaped me a lot. Even while I felt I was going through hard moments, but other girls were worse than me. They were forced into early marriages. They were not given opportunity to be in school. It was a very painful life.
Ayuro's father gave her a parcel of land upon which to build her school. She was 19. She was broke, and she had just become the mother of the second of her six children when she started this venture. She says it was the need to support her children that drove her ambition. Despite these handicaps, she graduated from high school and became the first student from her school to gain admission to a national university. She began teaching after graduating from Makerere University. At the same time, she launched several business ventures to acquire the money to pursue her dream. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
In a passionate speech in Washington last week, Britain's Prince William made a plea for the world to do more to tackle wildlife poaching. He linked the problem to terrorism. As Henry Richwell reports from London, the prince has long held an interest in conservation. He proposed to Kate Middleton while on holiday in a Kenya game reserve.
Illegal poaching for products like rhino horn and ivory has driven many iconic species close to extinction. In South Africa, conservationists say a record 1,020 rhinos have been killed in 2014 alone. The total population for the whole of Africa is estimated at just over 5,000. In his speech Monday, Prince William announced the formation of a task force to combat the trade.
Specifically designed to work with the transport industry, from airlines to shipping lines, to examine its role in the illegal wildlife trade and identify means by which the sector can break the chain between suppliers and consumers.
The prince accused organised criminals of looting the planet to feed what he called mankind's ignorant craving for exotic pets, trinkets, cures and ornaments.
Criminal gangs turn vast profits from the illegal killing or capture of wildlife. Armed groups and terrorists swap poached ivory for guns, and middlemen oil the wheels of the trade in return for reward.
That link between poaching and armed groups and terrorists is gaining increasing attention. In Kenya in recent weeks, Islamist Al-Shabaab militants based in Somalia have killed dozens of Kenyans in attacks on a bus and on non-Muslims working in a quarry. At a recent conference on conservation and security, Kenya's Secretary of State for the Environment, Judy Wakungu, said the two issues can be viewed through the same policy lens.
We share some very sensitive borders with countries such as Somalia, South Sudan, Ethiopia. Some of these problems have meant that we have faced increased levels of terrorism. And we do think that there is a connection to increased poaching.
With poaching expanding at an alarming rate, the search for a solution is becoming ever more urgent. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
It's time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Good Monday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we begin with rugby. Hosts South Africa beat New Zealand 26-17 to win the IRB Sevens Series tournament in Nelson Mandela Bay on Sunday. Canada beat Kenya 24-5 in the final of the ball category, while Samoa dismissed Zimbabwe 21-14 in the semifinals of the Shield category. Consequently, South Africa lead the series standing with 59 points. Kenya is 14th with 11 points, while Zimbabwe is jointly 16th with Brazil and American Samoa with 1 point. Turning to football, Ivory Coast dismissed Ghana 9-4 as Nigeria edged Senegal 5-4 in the Four Nations Beach Football Tournament in Lagos on Sunday. Early on Saturday, Ivory Coast pipped Nigeria 5-4 and Senegal beat Ghana's 5-2. On Friday, Ivory Coast outplayed Senegal 6-2 and Nigeria edged Ghana 75. Consequently, Ivory Coast win the tournament. Nigeria is a runner-up ahead of Senegal, then Ghana. In Morocco, Mexico's Cruz Azul came from behind to beat Australia's Western Sydney Wanderers 3-1 in extra time in heavy rain at the FIFA Club World Cup quarterfinals in Rabat on Sunday. Earlier in the day at the same venue, New Zealand's Auckland City pipped Algeria's Orange Africa Champions League title holders Etienne Setif by a solitary goal. In basketball, Tunisia's Radez beat the Democratic Republic of Congo's Mazembe 74-67 at the African Men's Club Basketball Championships in the Tunisian capital Tunis on Sunday. On Saturday, Angola's Libolo edged Tunisia's Club Africains 78-70. Egypt's Sporting Alexandria pipped Equatorial Guinea's Malabo Kings 77-76. Tunisia's U.S. Monastir beat Ivory Coast's Abidjan Basketball Club 66-59. Tunisia's ES Radez outplayed Nigeria's Mark Mentors 73-65, and defending champions Primero de Agosto dismissed Mazembe 82-65. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
And thank you, Monk. Have a very good day. And briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. A 22-year-old South African woman has won the 64th annual Miss World 2004 beauty pageant. Rolene Strauss, a medical student, was crowned this year's winner at the pageant on Sunday in London. Hundreds of millions of people around the world are estimated to have seen the ceremonies on television. Hungary's Edina Kuska came in second, and Elizabeth Safried of the United States was the third. More than 120 countries were represented. This year's pageant was marred by tragedy after the Honduran contestant Maria Jose Alvarado was found shot to death along with her sister last month. And that's it for this Monday, December 15th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for starting this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Strayak, as well as post editor Mark Ullman, along with our engineer Dave Magnus, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing you a very good day.
Next on Let's Talk, hairstyles in Africa. Hairstyles in Africa is the topic we'll discuss in a new lighthearted show, Let's Talk. So join me, Sandeep Shamari, and my guests as we explore hairstyles in Africa with some hilarity. That's Let's Talk, Monday at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
sports fans. This is Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports. Please join me Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. And on Fridays, you can also hear my 30-minute show at 17:30 UTC. On the internet, like me on Facebook, follow me on Twitter, and read my blog. Check voaafrica.com for the addresses and enjoy the show.